This is Ken Kimmel, March 16th, 1990. The Mystery of Rebirth.
Okay. Good evening, everyone, and welcome. We have a nice crowd tonight, and we're very pleased to welcome back Ken Kimmel, who, as you know, is a Jungian therapist in private practice here in Seattle. And he's also the director of the Pacific Northwest Center for Dream Studies. And he has presented for us in the past, and we're very, very pleased to have him here again tonight. Since 81, Ken has conducted many seminars and workshops all along the West Coast, and actually in Hawaii also. I'd love to go up to one of those myself, you know. And his specialty is in dream work and cross-cultural ceremonial art forms. Portions of his field research among healers and medicine people and mediums of Central and South America have been published in Stanley Krippner's Realms of Healing. Tonight we're pleased to have him speak for us on the mystery of rebirth. Ken, thank you.
Can everyone hear me back there? Very good. Very pleased to be here tonight. I knew something was in the air when just this evening, before I was ready to leave, a friend who'd been gone for the last 4 months was in Spain. And she just came back, pulled into town, and came over to see my wife. And she said, "Well, I'm back from the dead." I knew something was cooking. And then driving over the hill, I was behind this little white putt-putt car. And below the license plate, it said Ekin Car Traveler. And the Ekin Car, the cult that does the soul flight and the ascent of the astral traveling. So I knew something was in the air this evening. I'm glad to see so many people with an interest in the idea of renewal and honoring the time of spring. When I first began the preparations for this talk, I realized that I needed to bring out all my old research and writings from about 15 years ago that I compiled for my master's thesis on the healing and initiation practices and their relevance to dreams and the archetypal work in depth psychology. And much of it's comprised of the field work in Central and South America among healers, mediums, medicine men, and such. To tell you the truth, I procrastinated on getting the material together. I waited until February. And needless to say, I have a basement that's not unlike the Minotaur's labyrinth. And I couldn't find any of my research. I looked and couldn't find it. But it was only until I went back to my own essential dream material, my own inner work, in 1974 and 1975, that I began to connect to the real essence of what this talk is about. Namely, how these ancient symbols of sacrifice and renewal touch our lives. How they are meaningful, how they are the expressions of the movement of energy in our own inner transformation. In that moment of recognition, something was released, and I made a beeline right for my papers, and I found them immediately. And when this volume, this mass of papers was unearthed, lying on top of them was a tiny shred of copper wire, black wrapped around it, with just the very end exposed, as if it were inviting me to reconnect to some age-old wisdom, the wisdom of rebirth of the goddess and the great mother. So this really was my Ariadne's thread, connecting to that essential learning of death and renewal. The mystery of rebirth is a remembering process that comes out of the sacrifice and dismemberment of the old. It's a remembering or making whole with all that is unconscious within the self, all of the potential fruits of spring. It's a rite of passage from one stage of life into another, involving a transformation, a recharging, and a forward progression of energies. And rebirth in the classical sense represents the final stage in the transformation process in the initiation mysteries. Just as spring is the long-awaited birth of nature from out of winter. Looking at some of the archaeology that are found all over the world, the chambers of mysteries, whether in Egypt or in Greece or Chaldea, the Etruscans or the Mayans, they're always designed in the shape of a rectangle. And in the Mayan hieroglyph of the rectangle, it's the letter M, and it's pronounced Ma. Ma is the contraction of Mam. And it means the ancestor or the earth. Even the Egyptian hieroglyph of the rectangle also denotes the earth as well. So in these two great civilizations, we find that the ancient mysteries of initiation that were dominated in later years by the patriarchy all have their roots, or all derived from Ma, the Great Mother. 3 weeks ago, I had a dream, and I dreamt that I was delivering a research paper in a classroom setting to our instructor, Jung. And he assisted me in the translation of a Latin word, which I'd never heard, codex. And I had no idea the meaning of it. And then I began quoting in the research paper from Jung's own paper on psychic energy, which has turned out to be an essential thread connecting much of this talk tonight, which we'll be going into later. When I woke up the next morning, I looked in the looked for the Latin translation of codex, and it means the trunk of the tree. I think that Jung would want me to begin here with the tree. For the tree is the Great Mother. In the mysteries of initiation, the tree is often associated with a place of sacrifice and death and containment, and also the symbol of rebirth as well. My humble attempt at creating a depiction of a shamanic world tree. If you can't see, you might want to stand up if you're in the back just to look at this. This is a shamanic conception of the world. It was developed by the Warao of the Amazon, the Venezuelan Amazon. And they're a Mayan-descended people. The way they conceive of the world is that it's a disk. And circling the disk of the world is this universal ocean. And inside of this ocean is a great serpent that circles the entire ocean. In the center of the earth is the Axis Mundi, or the world tree. And in the shamanic initiations, there's a process of death that takes place, a ceremonial death that the shaman must go through. And the shaman leaves his or her body and ascends or descends to the upper world, which is inhabited by the four gods in the four cardinal directions, or down in the underworld, which is demons and ogres and monsters and such. So the entire cosmology is dome-shaped or egg-shaped. So already we're looking at when the shaman must die, there is a process of incubation that occurs, a going back to the beginning, going back to the Great Mother. The snake is the symbol of death and renewal. It sheds its skin. It's a common symbol in initiation. The tail swallower, once again, is symbolic of the inner containment of energies. When there's a death or a sacrifice, things go within. It's like the sealed vessel. The tree is the axis mundi, the world tree. It's like a ladder for ascent and descent. And when the shaman goes on his soul journey, oftentimes looking down at the earth, he sees very crude, very primitive mandalas. If he were to look down at this as an aerial view, he would see his cosmology as a perfect mandala or symbol of the self. So you find this throughout all of the shamanic practices. Very similar tree of life is depicted in the Elder Edda with the Yasidrigal, and you'll find another similar symbol in the Sumerian tree of life as well, with these three levels. So on the left here, we're going to be going through five basic stages. Sometimes the order shifts a little bit, but we're basically going to be sticking to be able to see the process of death and renewal in five basic cycles in the mysteries. The first is the sacrifice or death. It's like the burnt offering. Something is solid and it dies and it changes form. It becomes spirit. It goes into the smoke. It ascends. It goes up to heaven. So the sublimatio is the term for something solid turning to spirit. And this is the process in the idea of sacrifice and death at the hands of the ancestral spirits. The second stage is the ascension or descension along the world tree, which, depending upon the culture, can take the form of a journey like Psyche or Persephone going down to the underworld, or Osiris going on his journey. It can take the form of a soul journey, or it can take the form in more shamanic practice of ascension, of soul flight going up to the heavens. Like once again, the third stage is the Ouroboros. It's that regression. When there's the sacrifice and the death, people go back to the beginning, back to the time before birth, in the egg, when the opposites are still one. So it's a regression going backwards. And then inside the egg, or the Ouroboros, the tail-swallowing serpent, you have the conjunctio, the coming together of the opposites. What was low and what was high coming together, joining. The dark and the light, the male and the female coming together. And the last stage is the rebirth, or the ascent. Symbols of wholeness abound in this time. Births of babies are very, very common. Symbols of wholeness are very, very common. So this is the shred of, or the little line that's going to be taking us throughout the various mysteries and vision quests that we'll be talking about tonight, as well as the dreams as well. These five. And I'd like you to just be aware, while we're going through this process, exactly where you see it in the different dreams or the different myths. See if you can find the various stages in the talk this evening. I'm going to begin with a vision quest. This is an Ojibwa Indian vision quest from the plains of near the Canadian border. And this was an account taken by Paul Radin in the 30s of an Ojibwa boy's vision quest at a time of puberty. The recorders came to the old man and he said, "When God cleaned and arranged his great wigwam, I was swept out like a useless grain of dust." cast into a corner like a patch of dirt. As the whole room was prepared for the great festival, I lay my whole life in the corner, poor and forgotten, while others were dancing. I grew old in a night. What a great story, what great story can a man like me tell? He continued his humble introduction by saying that Kichi Manitou, the Great Spirit, had instructed all the prophets to have all the young boys at the time of reaching manhood or puberty to go into the forest to fast and train their thoughts to divine things. And a dream would come and tell them of their fate. Quote, consecration and devotion to deity and an eternal remembrance and good omen for their path of life. The boy Ojibwe was determined to go out into the snow of early spring without the aid of his grandfather. He went to a tall pine that he saw on an island in the middle of a frozen lake. And he climbed up the tree and prepared his dream bed in a tall red pine and laid the branches down and the moss down. The first 3 or 4 days he was terribly hungry. But on the fifth day, he felt no hunger, I can imagine. He fell asleep in a paralyzed state, but his soul was free. On the eighth night, he heard a big rustling in the brush, and he thought it was an elk or a bear, and he was ready to leave, and he flee because he was frightened. But then a man emerged and read the boy's fearful thoughts and alighted just above him and came to rest gently above him in the branches. And the man said, art thou afraid, my son? And the boy said, I no longer fear. Why art thou here in this tree? He answered, to fast, to gain strength, and know my life. The man answered that it was good, for the boy's answers were in accord with the spirit consultation that was going on right at that moment. It was being held for his welfare. Their decision was favorable, and he was the messenger sent by the Spirit Assembly with orders to invite the boy to see and hear it for himself. So the boy rose lightly from his body, and the two spirits flew higher and higher into the east until they came upon a wigwam on the top of a great mountain. At first there was only a great white stone, but soon appeared 4 men sitting around. He was beckoned to sit on the stone, but he began to sink, and one of the men said, oh, we forgot to place the white deerskin down, your foundation. So the stone grew solid when the deerskin was placed upon it. And a great council had assembled behind the 4 men. One of the 4 men ordered him to look down, and he saw the great earth below him. And another man took the word and asked the boy to look up, and he saw the heavens above him. The third man said to him, which way, up or down? And the boy said, up. And the 4th man said, ascend. And the back of the stone seat started growing very high as a ladder. And he started climbing to fantastic heights, where he came upon 4 old white-haired men hovering motionless around the pillar in the air. A dazzling cupola was arched above them. He wanted to go higher, but the men said no. They would not permit him to pass. But they told him he would have very good bestowed upon him. They said, look around thee. Thou seest here around us all the good gifts of God, health and strength and long life, and all the creatures of nature. He would grow to have white hair, be free from sickness, for they gave him a box of medicine. Whenever he was in need, he merely had to think of them and pray to them. He would be a great hunter, for they gave him all the birds and all the beasts and all the eagles of their great wigwam. He returned quickly as the stone before his feet melted, and he came to sit on the stone again. And the 4 men in the lower level were pleased that he had performed such a brave deed. They told him not to forget these teachings, for they would all be his guardian spirits. He went down to where his body was resting in the tree, and his soul re-entered his body, and he awoke as if from a long dream. He saw that his body had cut open and sucked the green branches for pine sap while he was gone. His body was in horrible condition. He was so weak he couldn't get back. And the snow had melted around the ice had melted around the lake. And so his uncle and his grandfather came with a canoe and brought him back. And on their way back, they came upon a bear, and he forbade his uncle to shoot the bear because he was instructed that for 3 days after, his medicine was too strong and he couldn't shed any blood for at least 3 days after. When he finally got back to his tribe, he rested for these 3 days and he said to End, "I was and remained a perfect man." So we see here that the tree is the point of ascension. It's the point of birth and renewal in the vision quest. A client of mine was telling me a story. She grew up in the 60s, and she went through her process of being a hippie and took her share of LSD. LSD, one of the things that happens with LSD is there's a loss of ego. And sometimes with that process, it can be a very profound transformative state, or it can be a very disruptive state as well. And this woman was in a relationship, I'll try to be brief, and the man up and left her suddenly. And she was very hurt because she was very close to the individual. And so the woman went down to California to a rock concert down in the Bay Area in Marin County, and she took LSD and regressed. She had a loss of affect. All of the feelings that she couldn't express about the loss were all imploded, and she was stuck. She couldn't speak, she couldn't communicate. She was in a lot of pain, but really couldn't express it. Her friends, rather than bringing her to a hospital, brought her over to some friends in Marin County who lived on a farm in the woods. And they just let her stay there. And she kind of did as she was told, so to speak. They would say, do this, do that, but she couldn't talk, she couldn't speak. She was all of her energy was regressed and inside. And her friends finally left. She was in the state for a couple weeks. And her friends left for the night, and she thought to herself, I can't stay like this. I've got to do something about this. So that night, she decided to take LSD again. Judgment call. And she went outside, and she saw this beautiful eucalyptus tree. You know the eucalyptus that has the peeling bark off of it that is so beautiful. And she went to this grand old tree and she just hugged it. And she hugged it and hugged it all night. Her experience was that she became the tree. She doesn't know exactly what happened, but all kinds of emotions must have come through her and out of her. She felt like the sap was running through the veins in her body. She felt that she was the tree. And what do you think happened the next morning? When she woke up with her arms around the tree, she'd come back. She had returned. She was still had some depression and some loss she was dealing with, obviously, but she had a profound transformational process. Because the LSD brought about the process of ego death, where you lose the ego, and she merged with the Great Mother. And so in this case, she went back to the beginning, to the roots of herself, to the roots of the Great Mother, and she was reborn again. So in this case, the codex, if we go back to my dream, the Latin word codex, the trunk of the tree is clearly a place of death and renewal. I'd like to move along to the mysteries of the Egyptian god Osiris. We have another codex symbol here. Rhea, who is the great mother, was pregnant with Osiris and his twin sister Isis. And while in the womb, they mated. And Horus was their offspring. When Osiris grew to power in Egypt, he was murdered through trickery by his older brother Set, who's the lord of the underworld. And it was also associated with the black boar, which is a common symbol of death and renewal in many of the mysteries. The way he tricked him into doing him in was he invited Osiris to this big celebration, a party, and he had fashioned this beautiful wood trunk. And he invited all the people of the celebration to try their luck at fitting in the trunk, and who was ever the best fit would get to keep the trunk. Ha ha. And so naturally Osiris was the best fit. And as soon as he got inside, he closed the lid and nailed it shut. He threw him into the Nile River, and was carried out to sea where he drowned. And interestingly enough, while in the underworld, Osiris mated with his second sister, Nephthys. So you see the incubation, there's this conjunctio that happens in the Osiris story. After completing the night sea journey, the coffer was washed ashore in Phoenicia at Byblos and came to rest in the branches of a cedar tree. And immediately the cedar tree sprang up and enveloped the trunk and it enclosed it in its own trunk. And there he rested. Meanwhile, the king of the country, who was purportedly the husband of Queen Astarte, who was the Sumerian Inanna, was taken by the tree. He loved the tree, so he had his men chop the tree down and just take the trunk of the tree and bring it back to his palace, where it was one of the pillars, or D-J-E-D, Jed, pillars, that supported the hall of his court. And the time period during Osiris's time away, the time of lamentation, was marked by the winter solstice as well. Meanwhile, Isis, his wife and sister, searched the world over, looking everywhere, lamenting. She cried, come to thy house, thou pillar. Come to thy house, beautiful bull, lord of men, beloved lord of women. So Isis came and found the god and cut the coffer out of the tree, wrapped the tree in fine linen, and anointed it. She brought Osiris back. Later, Set was back to his old tricks again and dismembered the body and scattered his pieces all over the world. And apparently, all the pieces were buried at various places of worship. Isis went the world over with the help of the jackal-headed Anubis and gathered all the parts together. She brought everything together except the phallus. And apparently the phallus had been eaten by fish. So Isis reconstituted Osiris, and in some sources, she gave him a wooden phallus, in some sources. But he still lacked the vital force, but the two mated anyway. And she gave birth to Harpocrates, who was considered weak in the feet and was always seen as a cripple. Osiris was a phantom. He wasn't his real self, but he helped his son Horus ready for battle to avenge his death with Set. And in the fight, Horus strikes off Set's testicles and defeats him, kills him. And earlier on, he gives up his eye to his father, who lost his eye to Set. But Horus's eye grew back. The dead or phantom Osiris is restored back to life with the help of the eye of Horus. And Horus, after defeating Set, assumes the two scepters of power as the new king of the earth. And Osiris is resurrected and ascends and becomes king of the spirit world. So Horus is the symbol of the rising sun, and Osiris is the symbol of the setting sun. So they're really two in one. They're really two aspects of the same god. So here we see the codex, in this case, the world trunk of the tree, as the container in death. Interestingly enough, the Eye of Horus in later Masonic ritual is the very same eye at the top of the pyramid in the American dollar bill. For the Masons were really the founding fathers of America. And if you look at it in a symbolic way, America was really born from Mother England. So I think it's important that we spend some time looking at this phenomena of the Ouroboros and of regression, because it's so essential in all of these stories that we've talked about, of going within. So I've turned to Jung's work on psychic energy for some ideas. And speaking psychologically of regression, which is the essence of the Ouroboros, the tail-swallowing serpent, or the egg, or Osiris's death trunk, Jung writes, "The libido, or the energy, regresses to the image of the mother in order to find there the memory associations by means of which further development can take place, for instance, from a sexual system into an intellectual or spiritual system." So the energy goes back in order to transform to another level, a higher frequency, subtler energy perhaps. In the Night Sea Journey, when the hero is swallowed by the whale, which is another analogy to the tail-swallowing serpent, Jung considers this regression of ego consciousness a necessary phase of development that resembles an early infantile state or even an embryonic condition within the womb. The Ouroboros, the great round, is the beginning, where the opposites of world, father, and mother are still united in one. This is Eric Neumann. It is a sealed system, the incubus, prior to birth. In the mysteries, the sacrifice brings the goddess or the god back to this embryonic beginning. The Ouroboric state is as dynamic a psychological process as the transformations of energy within a hydroelectric power plant. It imitates a raging waterfall, and by damming up its energies, creates a backward flow of kinetic energy that creates electricity from water. It's the same process. Jung states, the transformation of instinctual energy is achieved by its canalization, the diverting into canals, in other words, of the analog, or the analogy, of the object of instinct. I'll try to explain with an analogy. Jung illustrates this with a great example of a springtime earth impregnation ceremony that's practiced by the warriors of the Wachandi tribe of Australia. And during this time, they're forbidden to look upon women. They can't even talk to them. They can't see them during this period of time. Meanwhile, they build an oval hole in the ground and put brush around it to resemble the genitals of a woman. And then the warriors dance around the circle, thrusting their pelvises and thrusting their spears as erect phalluses into this hole, shouting, chanting, not a pit, but a vagina. Having no normal outlet for this energy, their libido is transferred from their object of instinct, namely the women, onto the analog, the earth mother woman, making the earth ripe with their expectancy for a fertile harvest and growth. She will bear fruit. In other words, a potential is created during this transformation of energies. So this is the meaning to the sacrifice in all the great mysteries. The great bull Osiris, or the death of Dumuzi in the Sumerian myth, who's also seen as a bull as well. Or Mithras, the slaying of the bull in the Persian mysteries. The cultural myth was reenacted in the ancient mysteries through real sacrifice of a bull. They would actually perform this process as a means of potentiating the earth and transforming the barren ground into fruitfulness. So when this transformation of energies takes place, the alchemical seal is ready to break open. The goddess is awaiting rebirth. The earth will renew and bear fruit. And the whale spits up the hero, rescued upon the wings of a bird at sunrise. The myth of the Sumerian goddess, the myth of Inanna and her descent, was written largely 3,000 years ago. I'm sorry, 3,000 years before Christ, on clay tablets. And it's the earliest recorded passage through the gates of metamorphosis and back again. It's the myth of initiation into the mysteries. She's the first to sacrifice herself for the sake of atonement and to receive the wisdom and the power from the dark feminine. Those initiates that partook in the rituals and ordeals of her mysteries in Samaria, and in the later mysteries that evolved from these rites, sought their own identification with the goddess, with the eternal, with the earth and with the heaven in their own nature. The mysteries brought a cosmic consciousness to the initiates, an awareness of their own eternal nature. This sacrifice, so that the spring planting would be fruitful, is a common cultural vegetation myth found all over the world. Inanna is the goddess of heaven, and she wishes to visit the funeral of the great lord Gugulana, who's the husband to her sister, Eriskigal. And Gugulana is called the great bull of heaven, and she descends to the underworld. Quote, "She abandoned heaven, abandoned earth, to the netherworld she descended. Her trusted executive was instructed that if she didn't return in 3 days, that she'd better go to the gods and see if they can help get her release. And at the first gate to the netherworld, Inanna must declare herself. She says, Queen of Heaven, with a place where the sun rises. She must request admission to the underworld, to the land of no return, to witness Gugulana's funeral. Her sister, Eriskigal, who is the goddess of the underworld, is furious and says, she demands that she is to be treated like every other person coming to the gates of hell. She is to be brought naked and bowed low. So each gatekeeper in the seven gates to the underworld remove a piece of her clothing until at the seventh gate she stands crouched and stripped bare, as the Sumerians were actually buried. She was judged by the seven judges, and Eriskigal kills her, and she hangs her on a peg, and her body rots and turns green So we have, once again, here's the tree again. This time as a peg, the tree of life. Again, a symbol of death. Meanwhile, the 3 days have elapsed and her executive goes before the gods and everyone refuses to help her. Everyone except Enki, who's the god of wisdom and of the waters. And she's helped by Enki's two assistants, who he creates from some dirt underneath his fingernail. And the two of them bring some of the water of life and some food and are able to pass through the gates of the netherworld without being seen. And they go to Erishkigal, who meanwhile is lamenting over all the death, all the loss. And they commiserate with her. And she feels their sympathy. And she allows them to take the corpse of Inanna back with her, with them. They give Inanna the water of life and the food, and she's immediately resuscitated. But upon leaving, Erishkigal says, "You may leave, but you must bring someone in your place to replace you." So all these demons flutter around her as she goes back each of the seven levels and gets a piece of her clothing back, one at a time, until she gets up to the upper world and she has to find a replacement. She's thinking, now who can I take? Well, I won't take anyone who was mourning my loss. So she comes upon her consort, often seen as the sun lover, Dumuzi, later known as Tammuz. And Dumuzi is sitting upon his throne, having a good time. And she looks upon Dumuzi with the eyes that Erishkigal looked upon her, those eyes of death. And she said, "You're the one." And the demons descended upon him, and he took off. He escaped. And in one depiction, Utu, who's the sun god, transforms him into a snake. And in another depiction, Dumuzi dreams of his own demise, his own sacrifice. And his sister, Geshtiana, helps to interpret the dream and helps him to get away. And when finally all is lost and there's no escape, she selflessly offers herself to be the sacrifice. And Inanna, in her wisdom, grants that the two brother and sister, Dumuzi and Geshtiana, will share the time. 6 months will be Geshtiana's time in the underworld, and 6 months will be Dumuzi's. And of course, their deaths and rebirths commence around the autumnal and vernal equinoxes, as all vegetation myth cycles. In the last line of the poem, it's written, "Inanna placed Dumuzi in the hands of the eternal. Holy Erishkigal, sweet is your praise." I'm about to share a very moving experience of a dream. I was working in a group context back in 1974, a group therapy, process-oriented group, and there was a woman there who, she'd been there a few months, and she had a very violent background. 4 years previously, she had been abducted by a gang and raped. And very tragic. She had repressed the experience and had not shared it with not even her mother. And they had told her, the gang had told her, if she breathed the word of it, that they'd do her in. She had to keep all of her feelings in. And so she came to the group. You could imagine she was pretty depressed. And not only that, but her sexuality, she was married, and she had no sexual feelings at all, which is understandable. She had no eye contact. She couldn't look at you. She would turn, her eyes had a kind of glassiness over them. She was very shy and timid. And for several weeks in the group, she kind of watched the process going on, didn't say anything. And finally, one morning, in the group, she announced that she'd had a dream that night before, a nightmare. And this is the dream. I'm buried under the ground, and I struggle to the surface. I see Jay and my husband. My husband points to Jay. Jay is this very aggressive, angry young man who was in the group, who was always kind of acting out in the group. And Jay comes at me with an axe. I'm too tired to fight. And he splits my body open, and my guts spill out. Very powerful, powerful dream. She was shaking as she was talking about this dream. Very moving. But the elements of initiation, death and renewal, were so apparent in this dream. And we trusted the process. Naturally, she had been buried. Her feelings had been buried under the ground. She was incubating, like in the wintertime, all of the feelings being submerged. And she was finally raising up to the surface to come out with her feelings, like the grain coming up in the springtime, or Osiris being reborn, or Dumuzi, or Inanna being reborn again in the spring. But she was terrified of her emotions. And so Jay represented that, that fear of the emotional life of all of her feelings. But the only way that she'd be able to experience to the experience of the rape. And with the support of the group, for 45 minutes, she shrieked and she cried and she sobbed and she thrashed. And all of the energy, all the emotions that she was forced to repress for all those years came out. And when she was all finished, it was like a veil had been lifted from her. It was like she was reborn. She had eye contact. That glassiness over her eyes was gone. She had contact. She had touched her emotional life, that dark, forbidden, dangerous place called the underworld within her, her depths, and brought them out by accepting that place in her that she was afraid of, allowing that process to occur. So, what about the axe? The axe is one little piece that I didn't connect to until just recently. And it turns out that archaeologists have unearthed some wares and figurines that date back to about 4500 BC, around the place where Southeast Asia Minor and Syria come together. And many of the symbols that were unearthed became prominent to the Cretan mysteries, which is a largely feminine mysteries in the Minoan civilization. And some of the things that were unearthed was the bull's head, here we have the bull again, and the double axe. And the double axe was wielded by the goddess, and it was her job to bring about the sacrifice in order so that there could be a renewal in spring. Jung has another quote which I'd like to share, and I think it's very pertinent to this process. Psychic development cannot be accomplished by intention and will alone. It needs the attraction of the symbol, whose value quantum exceeds that of the cause. In other words, the energy that's expressed in the contemporary imagery, in the symbolism, that energy must be more powerful than the immutable cause that keeps going on endlessly. Her rape was... her experience of the rape was buried. But the energy to keep that repressed was not strong enough to withstand the new symbolism of this rebirth, of this need to spill her guts. That symbol was what brought the canalized, created the possibility for the renewal of her energies. The symbols of initiation in dreams come as a rite of passage from the old into the new. When we're ready, we will transform. We can't push the river. We all have these images of transformation within us. All of us. Whenever we're coming upon great transitions in our lives, the symbols of transformation, the symbols of death and renewal will come to us. Sometimes not in these dramatic forms as these very deep emotional transformations that I've shared this evening. But certainly, whenever we must look at the opposite within us, that part of us that we don't own, whenever we must remember, bring those members of us, make ourselves whole, we must look at the dark side of ourselves. We have to bring forth those dark sides that bring us together in expressions of self, in symbols of wholeness and rebirth. I'm going to stop at this point and I'm going to ask for some questions, and then we're going to take a break, and then we're going to do a slideshow. So a picture paints a thousand words, and I think I'll be able to get some of these ideas, bring it back home by looking once again at these five stages. So are there any questions? Yes?
I'd like to make a comment.
Sure.
You were talking about the bull.
Yes.
And in the Cretan mysteries, I was very much interested.
Speak up. Can everyone hear?
I became very much interested in the prehistoric archaeology.
Yes.
And learned that the bull from Crete was carried to the Western Mediterranean and was found, and that the bullfight developed out of that. So is there a symbolism in the bullfight that is related to this rebirth?
Absolutely. Sure. It's the bullfights, I don't know extensively about it, but there's a whole ceremony of letting the bulls run through the streets, and you kind of take your chances out there. It's the bull, and we'll see a slide of the Mithraic mysteries. Again, this theme of the bull being sacrificed is age old. And there's a symbol of Mithras, the sun god, who's a Persian sun god, who sticks the dagger into the flanks of the bull, which is identical to the bullfight process. And from out of the blood of the bull springs the grain and all the symbols of rebirth that come from the blood of the bull. So the death in the bullfights originally was a pagan rite that became popularized in Spain, and it lost a lot of its the spiritual meaning to it, and became basically a bloodbath for bulls without the renewing quality in Mexico and even in Spain.
Well, there was another thing in Portugal. I forget the name of it, but this group of men come out and meet the bull on their feet, not by horseback. And some of them grabbed the bull by the tail, and then the leader was jump on the bull's head, which is very much like the bull dancers of ancient Crete.
Yes.
So that sort of is closer to the Cretan mysteries than the bullfight as it's fought in Spain and Mexico.
Yes. And Mithras also jumps upon the bull as well and rides the bull until it finally collapses and carries it on his back and goes to the cave for the sacrifice. Another question? Thank you. Comment? Yes?
As a book freak, I would like to know what's your list of your favorite books? Mm-hmm. As far as tonight's lecture is concerned.
Okay. Eric Neumann, The Origins and History of Consciousness, Eric Neumann, The Great Mother, Le Clos Géant, who's a French archaeologist who discovered the sepulchre, the tomb of Prince Ko of the Mayans in Chichen Itza, and his book is entitled Sacred Mysteries of the Ancient Quichés and Mayans. I've taken a lot from the Cults of the Greeks, which is an incredible five-volume, I forget the name of the author at this time. Anyone know? Betty, do you know the name? There's one full book on the Eleusinian mysteries, and we'll be dealing with the Eleusinian mysteries tomorrow. I probably already inundated you, but I didn't want to inundate you so much with one after the other. But we'll be talking more about the mysteries of Eleusis and Demeter and Persephone tomorrow, and more experientially. Let's see, what else? Joseph Campbell, his Mass of God, the Occidental mythology, primitive mythology. Let's see. If I think of some more, I'll let you know.
Thank you.
Any other question or comment before we take a break? Yes.
Is it true that it was the agricultural societies that had the more sacrifice for renewal and all, that they really, rather than the hunting and gathering, they didn't have as much of the death sacrifice?
Well, you find it in both cultures, but in the shamanic cultures, they were primarily hunter-gatherers, and there was more of a symbolic death that occurred through the mysteries. So there was a death symbolism, but it took different form. They didn't sacrifice in the same kind of way with the animals but there was some human sacrifice in the shamanic cultures as well. Any other question? Oh, good. Oh, yes.
Well, when you talk about the axe, maybe I'm not correct, but my feeling was that it was really the double-sided axe was where the cross came from, which makes sense to me. That was my feeling. That was the symbolism to me.
Yes. Well, we'll be talking about the cross in the slides. The cross is a very important symbol in death and renewal, the obvious Christian symbolism, but the cross has been an age-old symbol. The peg that Inanna was on was like a cross as well. So we'll be talking more about that. But that's a nice image, seeing the double-sided axe as the cross. Yes?
I'm interested in, you mentioned seeing mandalas as they go, as the shamans going to death.
Yes. They go up, when they ascend this world tree, and they're looking down, they see this. Mm-hmm. And we'll be seeing a lot of some slides of the Chumash dream maps, which are basically soul flight, and some of the Wecholi Indian soul flight as well. And they all, even though they're in different places, they have the same very simple, they're called churingas on the Wecholi, just simple crosses with circles. And yeah, I interrupted you. What were you going to...
I have, near death or whatever, I saw some images that were, they're pulsating patterns, weavings, and I'm going to do an independent study on Celtic mysticism and the powers of the famous ceremonial rites and things. And I was real curious if you knew of a book that had drawings of the weavings that the Celts and the gay,
I don't know offhand. I once had a calendar that had all of them with beautiful descriptions, and I know that came from a central book. There are. Does anyone know of a book on Celtic, the Celtic crosses? It's interesting that in Maya land, there's a wonderful book called The Two Crosses of Todos Santos. And it's by Maud Oakes, who's sort of a Jungian anthropologist. And what we find, whenever you do any anthropology or archaeological studies in any of the places where the Spaniards conquered, raped, and pillaged, you find that they destroyed the temples. These temples to the sun and the moon and such, and the stars, and they would erect their own churches over the same places where these temples were, because they felt that they were places of power, and they would be able to acquire the power and the energy. So in Maya land, in Guatemala and parts of Mexico, in this one place called Todos Santos, there's this very Catholic cross in the courtyard. And then as you go further out of town, there's this tall wooden cross with the cross section way high up. And this is the Mayan tree of life. And you'll find that in many, many cultures, and you find in Brazil, you find in Maya land that have been conquered by the Spaniards, the Catholic pantheon with the saints and Jesus and Mary and such, they're about a quarter of the inch thick, and underneath is rich Mayan symbolism and ceremonialism. It's really fascinating. So they've just given new names to the rain god and to the sun god. Any other questions or comments? Okay, why don't we take a break, and we'll come back and say 10, 15 minutes, and we'll have a slideshow.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.